You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So, I want to tell you a little bit about Jamaica Kincaid and Cyril Ogilvie. Jamaica Kincaid was born in St. John's, Antigua, where she received, as the BBC noted, an English education. She was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and her many books include At the Bottom of the River, a series of lyrical vignettes focusing on the growing consciousness of a young girl in the Caribbean. Other books include Annie John, Lucy, The Autobiography of My Mother, My Brother, Mr. Potter, My Garden Book, she is a wonderful writer about plants and gardening, and the novel See Now Then. She's a recipient of the Lannan Literary Award in Fiction, among many other honors, and she's currently teaching at Harvard. And we all know that Jamaica thinks and cares passionately about words. She once commented to a reporter, "I've been up all night working on a sentence." So we were thrilled that she was available and game to join our Oxford English Dictionary project in conversation with linguist Cyril Ogilvie to explore the idea of the OED as a truly global enterprise. In her book, Cyril Ogilvie's book, Words of the World, A Global History of the Oxford English Dictionary, she quotes the OED's first editor, Sir James Murray, telling students at Oxford, "Hardly any word from a foreign language looks odd or out of place among our home words." So I'm sure we'll hear more about that tonight. Sarah joins us from Palo Alto, where she teaches linguistics at Stanford. Her book on the OED has been praised both for its deep practical knowledge of the OED, for the author's analytical skills, as well as her warmth and flair as a storyteller. And did I say that she was an editor at the OED? And we'll probably hear some more about that tonight as well. Please join me in welcoming Jamaica Kincaid and Cyril Ogilvie to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you, Louise, for that very warm introduction, very generous introduction. It's such a pleasure to be here and such an honor to be here with Jamaica Kincaid.
We are a mutual admiration society. I adore her book and have given it to many people. So it is an extraordinary honor to talk to you about words. And thank you, Louise, and Ken, and Rebecca. I've known Ken and Rebecca for many years, I think since I had little children. But anyway, thank you, and thank you for coming. How shall we begin?
Well, maybe we should begin at the beginning, which is your childhood. It would be really wonderful to hear more about your childhood and how you were first introduced to books and reading.
And the dictionary. One of the criticisms people sometimes have about my work is that I have long sentences I use simple words I don't think they notice I repeat words. But in any case, the reason for this I came to see, there are three big influences on my writing. The Bible, the King James version of the Bible, John Milton, Paradise Lost, books 1 and 2, not the rest, just books 1 and 2. And the concise Oxford English Dictionary. My mother was a big reader, and I was an only child, and I used to annoy her when she was reading. So she thought that if she could teach me to read, I would leave her alone. And so she taught me to read, and I didn't leave her alone. I wanted more reading. And so by the time I was 3, certainly I could read, but by the time I was 3 and a half, they had to get me out of the house. And so I was sent to school. But you could only go to school when you were 5. And I was told to say I was 5 when I was 3 and a half. And if you like, you can associate that with my making a connection between reading, writing, and telling a fiction. In any case, by the time... two things happened when I was 7. I did something bad in school because I could... I was pretty much smarter than anybody else in my class, but and they were older than... I was always with older kids. So I did something disruptive in class, and I... the punishment for it was to copy books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost, which had the wonderful effect of having me fall in love with Lucifer, as would be predicted. And the other thing, when I was 7, I was given for my birthday by my mother a copy of the Concise Oxford Dictionary. It was the concise, a tiny dictionary, and I read it the way you would a book. I began with A and I ended with Z, the last word, and I would read it again and again, and that alone is a significant influence on my writing, the dictionary. We were talking earlier about the reasons to use a dictionary. I always use the dictionary or want the dictionary to tell me, to explain to me a word is the way...
Something that you don't know.
Something that I do not
know. Or you want to check, yeah.
Yes, something that I do not know. I want it to tell me something that I do not know. And I use it constantly, even... now, just constantly looking things up. Sometimes even if I know what it means, I want to be sure, because I really hate when I come across a writer who has used a word in a wrong way or in a slightly off way, that word doesn't really mean that, and then I can't read the piece anymore. So I'm,
really?
I'm always looking for, does that word mean that?
So there is a right and wrong for you.
There is a yes. So, and I count on the Oxford dictionary, not the Webster's dictionary, but the Oxford dictionary.
And so, when you went to school on Antigua, was there a distinction between British English and Caribbean English? Were you ever? What was the relationship between the two? Were the teachers trying to get the children to embrace their local variety of English, or were you steered towards British?
Absolutely not. You were not allowed to speak what we called broken English that you would now hear in reggae. You were not allowed to speak that in front of an adult, certainly not your teachers. And in fact, I now no longer can speak what you call broken English. So when I go home to visit my family, I can't really understand what they say.
So you would leave school and go home and people would be speaking Caribbean English at home?
They There'd would, but I wasn't allowed to. If you were going to be a decent young woman or a decent person, you weren't allowed to speak that way. There was a BBC English or a book English that you spoke. Only bad children spoke that way. And so I never... I spoke that way, but not so anyone could hear. And then as soon as I left home, I quickly lost the ability to do it.
So when you moved to New York when you were 16, did you make a conscious decision to be speaking a variety of English that was American rather than Caribbean? Or did it just happen naturally?
I made an effort, and I think the last thing my mother said to me is, make sure you can speak so people can understand you. And I thought by that she meant the way someone on the BBC sound, which is why I sound like this. I mean, I just never got rid of the idea that I should speak in this way, that I should pronounce words in this way. I never spoke Caribbean English, and there's a variety of Caribbean English, as there is, of course, the other islands that are not English-speaking, you know, Francophone islands, they speak, they actually speak Creole, which is separate from France, and they have developed a real system for it, that they can write in Creole. We can't really write in, I mean, I think some people try, but you can't really write in it. People write in it in spoken poetry or reggae, but you can really hear it in, you know, Bob Marley.
You do include a lot of Caribbean words in your writings. So is that a conscious decision when you're writing about your own culture and the content?
I don't know that I do so much. And I'm sometimes accused of not putting enough of that in. I'm often accused of not putting Caribbean English or not talking about, not describing someone's race enough. I'm often accused of those two things.
Because in preparation for tonight and in thinking about the Oxford English Dictionary as this quite radical text for the mid-19th century, never before had there been a dictionary that truly tried to describe words rather than prescribe their meaning. And the dictionary was a very democratic dictionary in both its making, in the sense, and in its content, because they wanted to, for the first time, to describe every word in the English language, and they realized that to do that, they needed to gather evidence of words in written sources. And they realized that a small group of men then in London in 1859, but then eventually in 1879 when the project moved to Oxford with James Murray, they realized that it would take more than just a small group of men to do that. So they put out this global appeal to the English-speaking nations, and they asked people to read their local books and to send them in citations giving the date, the author, the title, and then the example of the local word. And when I was thinking about the 19th century edition, the first edition of the OED, I did wonder what their coverage of Caribbean English was. So I looked through a few of your books, and I gathered a list, just a little sample of 25 words. And they were from, and they were words such as dasheen and Edo's and pepper pot.
Yeah. Food.
Sour sop.
Yes.
But that they were all in, and I was so fascinated to discover that the first edition has, of the 25 words that I looked up, 21 of them were there.
Yes.
But perhaps most interesting are the ones that weren't. So there were four that weren't. Benna.
Ah, Benna. Yes, you're right. And I would not have...
which is really a folk song, yeah. Just so you know.
It's, yes. It might be characterized as a folk song, though in fact it's any song that's not a hymn.
Because in The Girl, there are two references to Benna. Yes. You mustn't sing Benna on a Sunday.
That's right.
You did sing Benna in Sunday school.
Yes. Benna was anything that was not a hymn. So that, in particular, that I'm referring to, that Benna, is any song that was calypso. In particular, a song by the Mighty Sparrow about a girl named Marie. And there was a girl named Marie who lived around the corner from us, and she was incredibly beautiful, and she ran off with the Mighty Sparrow, and he wrote a song about her. I was just singing it to Derek Walcott the other day. I love the way you walk, Marie. I love the way you talk, Marie. And I just used to love that song.
And that is Benna.
That is Benna. And I wanted to be Marie. I wanted to run off with the Mighty Sparrow. And my mother must have known that. But Benna, Dasheen is a root starchy...
like taro.
Like taro. And I think it comes from Africa. They must have brought it with... Slaves must have brought it with them.
The
Edo also. Those are all African foods. But those... I think those words, Edo, might be the a word that came from Africa.
And Edo is a very old word, so the entry in the OED, it's a small taro root, and I think the first citation is 1685. Dasheen comes into a written source not until 1899, so that doesn't occur in the first edition, but it does come in straight away in the 1933 supplement.
Mm.
And that's... In my book, when I researched the differences between the 1933 supplement and the later supplement that came in the 1970s and 80s, the statistics showed that, in fact, this 1933 supplement includes a much higher proportion of words from outside of Britain than the later supplement. And so that's just another example that Dasheen comes there. But soursop, which is a type of fruit, that's in the first edition. Chocho, which I think in Australia we refer to as choco, which grows on a vine, that's in. But Christophine isn't, and you use the word
Christophine. Yes.
And that's not...
I don't know where Christophine comes from, though I saw it growing in a village in Nepal. And I was walking around and I saw it and I thought, oh, they have Christophine too. So I don't know if it's Asian. But there are all these things. Now, what's interesting is, would there be a person in England reading my book and wondering what this is, Edo, and so on, and would they go... to the dictionary. So, which brings me to this idea I got from your book. I really, really just love this book. It seems to me that the dictionary ended up having an influence, or what is it I want? It ended up being something that they may not have thought it would. You say it's democratic. I'm not sure that they thought of it as consciously democratic as we now see it is. And I suppose I like that even more about it, the unintended consequence of this book, of this dictionary, you know, that it would have sought out words from... all over the English-speaking, but it's the English influence world.
Mm. Throughout the Commonwealth.
Yes, it's throughout the Commonwealth or in those days, the Empire.
Yes, and I think that that's right. I think that the editors were probably being very true to the scientific approach which came over from continental philology in the mid 19th century, and they really, really, really took that up. They wanted to look at a word historically and give a biography of the life of a word, and really rigorously research it and show you its very first usage, and then throughout the centuries, show you examples of how it was used until the current day. So that's a diachronic dictionary across time, diachronos, whereas the small concise dictionary which you had is a synchronic dictionary that just looks at words and language in one moment in time. And so I do think that those early editors were probably being as true as they could to that scientific approach to English, but then what I discovered in the archives, which are underneath in the basement of the dictionary, everything is kept, all of the letters, all of the little slips of paper. So when people around the world were asked to read their local books, they were asked then to write out the citation on a 4x6 slip of paper, and then they sent them into Oxford. And the editors really had no idea of how successful their appeal would be, but it was so successful that Royal Mail had to put a post box outside James Murray's house, especially for the ebb and flow of this correspondence. But what struck me down in the archives were that when they would draw up drafts of the dictionary, the consultants would complain about the presence of foreign words. The delegates of the press would complain, and I found letters, as you'll read in the book, where they say, you must delete these foreign words. But time and time again, James Murray and all of the editors kept them in. Mm. Many of the reviews of the dictionary were saying, why are there these foreign words there which are decaying our language? But time and time again, they kept on putting them in. So I'm not sure how... I like to think that they were, first of all, true to the scientific method, but second of all, really seeing English as any word that is current and spoken within English, which is certainly the current approach as well.
Within, would you say, within the influence of the English world? The British world, or
yes, or just anywhere, as long as a word is used in an English context, that is an English word.
Yeah. Well, one thing, and I before you, I forget to ask you this. I really want you to tell or explain to me a little bit more the way different people, men and women, responded to... There's a part in the book where you say they sent out books, Stanley's Journal...
And Livingston's was it?
Journal,
yes.
To things like that, to different people, sometimes to a man, sometimes to a woman, and the different ways the... it broke down along gender lines. Can you say...
Yeah, sure. So I was very surprised, and my research now is also revealing just how many women were part of this reading public. So it looks like about a quarter of all the contributors and the readers were women, and also about a fifth of them were from America. So there were... many people here, hundreds of people in America, reading American sources and sending them in as well. I think that what you're referring to is, I was interested in the question, how subjective is this process? I mean, this could be any of us just reading our books at home, choosing a word and sending it in, and then suddenly that word is legitimated and standardized and put into the dictionary. So I thought it would be great to look at either look at a book that two different contributors read and look at the types of words that they highlighted, or look at very similar books. So I looked at two books written by Livingston, and they were his travels through Africa. One was sent to a Miss Blomfield in London, and the other was sent to a Mr. Griffiths living in Hereford, both of them in Britain. And it was fascinating to see that that Mr. Griffiths chose very common words like table and just everyday words which you would find in any book. And you didn't get a feel for the fact that this book was Livingston's travels through Africa whatsoever, whereas Miss Blomfield's words were wonderfully colourful. Many of them were indigenous terms that Livingston was referring to. So I found that really interesting, to just show how subjective this whole process was. Murray actually encouraged readers. There were many letters where he would write to people saying, please, please do try and highlight the more peculiar words, which does show us that he was particularly looking for that kind of texture. Yeah. But as for whether that was a particular female way of reading or not, I don't have a wider evidence for. Yep. Just in those two cases, the woman was more receptive to the more foreign word.
Uh-huh. I immediately drew from that just some sort of wild understanding of the world, or my understanding of the world, I thought, well, of course a woman or a person with a confined life, I assumed the Miss Blomfield.
Miss Blomfield. And in fact, she is one of four sisters, and they all read for the dictionary, and they all sent in slips, and their father did as well. And I must say that I do picture them sitting around the gas lamp at night, reading and writing out slips
together. It would be interesting if one could get that, to see what he picked out and what they picked out. Because I often immediately thought, in reading that, that the woman's life, as I said, would have been more confined. So the whatever she was reading would have excited her, again, identifying with the person who read. Because when I read, when I read, there was no me anymore. All I became the book. So I just imagined the person reading the book being a woman and a confined person. I suppose imagining that that person is me as a child in Antigua, confined, I would have found all the words that were in situations that were unfamiliar, and I would have put in all the unfamiliar things and sent them off to Mr. Murray. And the evidence I have of that, of course, I told you that, again, having to do with my misbehavior, my bad behavior in school, I was given Jane Eyre to read, and my school teacher thought that that would quiet me. And it did. And so I read it, and lo and behold, I found a word in it, and the word is gloaming. And I had never I've never heard of gloaming. I didn't know what it was, so I looked it up. I found it. And so I must have been about 10 when that happened. And finally, when I was 28, I remembered this word all through my life until I still remember it. But I always wanted to use it, and I could never find a sentence in which to put this word. And finally, when I was 28 or so, and I was writing a short story, I found a sentence in which it fit. I've used it more than once now.
And it's now on page 63 of At the Bottom of the River, where Jamaica writes, "Now comes the gloaming, for day will end."
Oh, gosh, let me see if I can find the... The first time I came across this word. This is Mr. Rochester speaking to Jane after she's returned from visiting the horrible her horrible relatives. Mrs. Reed has died, so she's returned, and she says, he asks her where she's been, and she says, "I've been with my aunt, sir, who's dead." And he says, "A true Janian reply. Good angels, be my guard. She comes from the other world, from the abode of people who are dead, and tells me so when she meets me alone here in the gloaming." And I can actually remember just thinking, in the gloaming, what could that
be? Because did you have twilight?
We did not have twilight. And that is why the word... stuck out. What could that be, gloaming? Well, everything in the book, I mean, there are many passages in the book when I read it for the first time. It was just a wonder of atmosphere. The atmosphere, if anything, among the signal qualities of Jane Eyre is atmosphere. It's always some, people are always in some mist, or it's all atmosphere. Lots of atmosphere. So this gloaming business, I just thought, what could it be, gloaming? Because in the Caribbean, it's either night or day. It's nothing in between. The sun sets, it's dark. The sun comes up, it's light. It's just sort of like that, you know, on, off. So this idea of gloaming. And then one day when I was in North America, I was somewhere, and I just had this shiver. I thought, oh, that's it. Gloaming, this thing, gloaming. Isn't it a beautiful word?
It's a great word. It is.
So, yes, I would be that person who would pick out, or not table, not chair, not floor, not sky?
Well, you know, Jamaica, you are quoted 13 times in the Oxford English Dictionary.
I am?
You are. And what's so fascinating is when you look at those words, I was particularly interested in half of them because when you look at them, they are actually very old English words. So they are using, so for example, in Lucy, you refer to a gay dress, meaning a brightly coloured dress. That's a very old sense of the word gay. A stone heap. Linen drying on a stone heap. You use that in a piece in The New Yorker. And is a stone heap, are they hot stones that then help dry the sheets?
No, it's a stone heap, and it's something you would have made for you. In the middle of the yard, a bunch of stones piled up on top of each other. And, you know, until now, I haven't even... Oh, dear, just this sort
of... It can't be your daughter. She's here.
This is just the sort of thing that is annoying, and I'm guilty of it. Now you see why I had to copy books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost. But the architecture of it I not really thought of, but a heap of stones, carefully constructed, usually round, in the middle of the yard, or off to the side, in any case, not in the way. Mm-hmm. The clothes, and in my story, Girl, I narrate the week of washing. That's the right. White clothes were washed first, and they would be put out on the stone heap, because that was the way of bleaching out the stains, mm-hmm. Because we didn't have Clorox or things like that. Incidentally, Josephine, Napoleon's wife, used to send her white clothes, her summer clothes, to Martigny to be washed because she thought the sun was better there.
Oh, my goodness. That's luxury.
It's luxury and a kind of imperiousness that is practically a fairy, a magical invention. The idea that the sun would not be the same sun in France, but a more delicious sun, but only for her clothes.
That's right.
The sun in Martinique is kinder to her clothes than it is to the people in Martinique. Mm.
And then more of those wonderful old words which you use are another instance was your use of the word wanton, to be a wanton hue.
Ah.
So it is wanton referring to colour or to music. Also a riplet, meaning a little ripple. A riplet.
That's so interesting.
That's in Lucy.
It only shows that my education was an education of empire. That, for instance, I did not read a book that was written after Kipling. I think Kipling was the last book.
So, yeah.
And it wasn't considered literature. It was one of those things I just read. I mean, it would be, because I think Kipling is now revered or something, but we were just thought, oh, yes, you can read that. But the things that I read, and it's, the influence, I hadn't gained, I realized that, but the things I read in my education would be Wordsworth, Milton, of course, Shakespeare, hardly any novels, really. It was poetry, a lot of poetry, a lot of plays. I think I had an education, and a lot of us did. You know, The Mighty Sparrow did, Derek Walcott did, Naipaul did. We had an education that must have been designed by people who went to Eton and then went off to work in the Commonwealth Office. Mm-hmm. Apparently 600 people ran the British Empire. And one of them designed...
4 million people.
Is it 4 million?
It was back then.
Back then.
At its height, yeah.
Well, 600 million people.
400 million, sorry. Yeah.
Wow. Right. But we had an education that was designed by someone who had an extraordinary education, and thought it would be a good thing to give to us. And it was in its way. Again, it had a devilish purpose, because it was meant to show us the glory of England, not Great Britain, England. See England. Because at the end of it, we had nothing really to do with it. You know, we weren't expected to become doctors or nurses or scientists, or certainly not writers. But we had this fabulous education. I used to know all sorts of things about Caesar in Britain. Just sort of, you know, Roman Britain. Just for the fun of it. You know, and there was a certain moment, I've written about this in Lucy, where it dawned on me that there were things I was being taught that I would never really see or never really understand, so that I had to memorize "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud," and which is a really great poem, and my daughter can testify to this. I sort of came to hate daffodils and would just say mean things about them. And then at some point it dawned on me that it wasn't Wordsworth's fault, so I planted 10,000 daffodils.
Ah, that's great. So with respect to those words, Jamaica, I'm really interested to hear you tell us about your education, because the interesting thing about your use of each of those words which I just mentioned is that you are the first quotation in the OED since a very long time. So, for example, "riplet," which you used, the previous quotation is 1914. "Wanton," really? The previous quotation is 1915. "Ripe too," so in Annie John, you refer to something being ripe to harvest, so ready to harvest. That's a very old usage of "ripe too," oh. And that before you didn't occur since 1908. So what I was wondering with my linguist's hat was whether they were fossilizations, so whether they were old English terms that came with the British to the Caribbean and then fossilized and kept their meaning there but died out in usage back in Britain.
It's amazing. That really is an interesting thing. I think... the way I use words, you know, as I say, the influence is in the
19th century literature. Absolutely. So they're not fossilizations.
Yeah. And not only me, you know, I think you certainly can see it in Derek Walcott and in Naipaul. You can see, I don't know about the African English-speaking writers, how do you say, Anglophone Africa, how they're writing, if you can see the same thing, but certainly in the Caribbean, the English-speaking writers, and I don't know about the younger generation, but the idea of speaking English correctly was very important to us. Not just correctly, but there was some kind of beauty in it that people loved, sort of the way they came to love cricket, you know, and play cricket, with a kind of elegance that, from forever, I mean...
And is that still the case now, back home?
I don't think so. I think that the American influence has taken over, the American easy way of using language and of mashing up language is much more prevalent. But No, I think in my generation, or maybe even a little after, you could certainly see it in my brothers, who the youngest one was 13 years younger. And we all had a way of speaking that must have been, as you say, old, that... and the other thing that would have been an influence on the way we speak is that a lot of us were Methodists and Moravians, and the hymns were very, a big influence. You can see it in Marley.
And in fact, another of the words quite particular to the Caribbean, which I noticed in your writings, is the word Jah, which is the Rastafarian word for God.
Yes.
From Jehovah and Yah,
yes.
The Hebrew,
yes.
Yah.
Yeah. No, it's it's an interesting thing. The dictionary. There are two things I think that are related to the dictionary. The other thing that's related to the dictionary in the Anglophone world is the Botanic Garden.
Yes.
That those were the library and the Botanic Garden. Mm. And they are a Botanic Garden is a library in its way.
Classification of plants.
Yeah.
Examples from all around
and
the world.
And arranging.
Yeah,
them.
There is a similarity.
There's a similarity to them. And the British Empire, there were two things it would establish wherever it settled: a library and a botanic garden. And
and it's funny that you should mention plants and the botanical, because many of the readers for the dictionary back in the 19th century were people who were fascinated by botany, and I was intrigued when I discovered that all of these Caribbean words were in that first edition. So I dug a little deeper to see who were these people reading books on the Caribbean and sending in slips. And one of them was Dr. Richard Pryor, who in fact had been to the Caribbean. He was a botanist at Kew Gardens, and he had been to the Caribbean and had collected and described 4,500 Caribbean plants. And apparently there is a genus named after him in the Caribbean called Priora.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with
Priora? No, I'm not. And one of the things that's annoying to me is how little I know about native Caribbean plants, because I can't find any books on it. But so his might be a source.
His works.
But the other thing, I would love to see it, because the other thing about the Caribbean is that many things that you think are indigenous to the Caribbean come from somewhere else. It's a very interesting landscape, and it's a landscape that becomes that way because of Captain Cook. That journey he made was one of the great redistributors of vegetable.
How fascinating.
Material in the world. He had a botanist with him named Joseph Banks, who was the founder of Kew, the first director of Kew Gardens. And it was Banks who introduced tea to India. Indians never drank tea before.
And it's also... Oh, sorry, say.
No, I mean, he's one of these people who just not only changed the vegetable matter growing in places, but he, changed cultures so that this thing, Indians have a whole thing about tea, but they never had it before.
Yes, and Joseph Banks also took... the word kangaroo, because I am Australian,
yes.
Took the word kangaroo from Australia back to England. And when you read Boswell, there's this wonderful scene of Samuel Johnson is having a dinner party, and Joseph Banks is there. And Joseph Banks gets up and impersonates and hops and shows them what a kangaroo does. And that was all thanks to Captain Cook when they were going close to the coast of northern Queensland, which is my home state. They struck a reef and they spent 6 weeks mending the hole at a place which is now called Cooktown. And that's where they met the Gugu Yimajir people.
Wow.
And that's how they got the word kangaroo from Gugu Yimajir. Yes.
Oh, amazing. Anyway.
So we do have time soon for some questions, but is there anything else, Jamaica, which you wanted to share?
Oh, gosh, there's so much. This conversation could go on because I could just... but I think it must...
Shall we open to the floor? And please feel free to ask questions. There is a roaming mic.
Two questions, very quick. Do you have a favorite word from Shakespeare? And when you were 16, what took you to New York and what did you do there?
Oh, gosh. Favorite word from Shakespeare? Gosh. I wouldn't say so, a favorite word. You should say favorite play or favorite scene, but I wouldn't say a favorite word. I can't think of a favorite word. No, I'm not going to. I was almost 17 when I went to New York. I was sent to New York to work as a servant to support my family. I was the oldest child, and my parents had too many children, and they did what people who have too many children do. They send the other ones, the elder ones, off to be serfs.
And how did you migrate to becoming a writer?
it's a good question. I had always wanted to be a writer, I guess, but I didn't know it was possible. And once I was free of my family and the things I grew up with, I went to college. Dropped out and decided I wanted to be a writer, and then just started to write. And in less than 10 years after I left, I was sent away from Antigua, I was writing for The New Yorker. But that's a whole... I know. And it's a series. It's, you know how people fall into things? I just... I basically was a fool who... did things that a wise person would not have done. And they turned out all right. Thank you. Thank you.
Wonderful talk, and certainly the people here, myself included, are lovers of books. But I was wondering how much technology and the internet is influencing the work of the OED going forward.
That's a good question.
It definitely does. So now, of course, we can search large databases of collections of texts, so we can now find and fill gaps which we couldn't before. But we still do rely on readers, because of course the technology is not yet sophisticated enough to decipher nuances of meanings within the same word. We still rely on people all around the world reading books for us and sending us in slips. And in fact, it was thanks to one man doing that I really became interested in this. I was about 20 when I was 20, I was working for Oxford Dictionary down in Australia. And one of my jobs when I first started was to open up the mail. And every month would come this package of slips, these little 4x6 slips, and they all came from this one person called Mr. Collier. And Mr. Collier lived in Brisbane, which happened to be my hometown, and he only gave us a return address of a P.O. box number. So we didn't know much about this mysterious Mr. Collier, except for the fact that these slips arrived always wrapped in cornflake boxes with bits of dog hair and cat hair, all so we hoped that it was dog hair and cat hair. And I'd sort of open these and see these slips. And so then when I went to work at the OED over in Oxford, people said, oh, you're Australian. Do you know Mr. Collier? So Mr. Collier was sending slips not just to the Oxford Dictionary down in Australia, but also over to Oxford. And the other very unusual thing about Mr. Collier is that every single quotation was from a single source, from the local newspaper of Brisbane called the Courier Mail, which is a really dreadful newspaper. And so, as you'll see in the book, I just did a little experiment, and I've looked through. So Mr. Collier sadly died about 6 years ago, but before he died, he started contributing to the dictionary in 1974, and he contributed over 100,000 slips.
Wow.
And I got to meet him, which was a story within itself, which I think I describe in the book. And after meeting him, I said, you know, we would really love to fly you over to Oxford to thank you for this mammoth contribution. Would you like to come to Oxford and see the work of the editors? And he paused for a moment and said, oh, but I couldn't possibly, just imagine all the courier mails waiting for me on my return.
I want to ask one question. Do words ever get out of the dictionary?
They never leave the Oxford English Dictionary. If a word becomes obsolete, then a little dagger obsolete sign is put beside it.
But it never leaves.
No.
Gosh, that's a kind of novel in itself, you know, a word goes to a place where it never leaves. That's wonderful.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying this talk. Do you ever have something that's a change in the language that you feel was a misuse at one time, and it's now become accepted? Two-part question. Number one, do you have one that is just fingernails on the blackboard to you to hear, but it's now accepted by the OED or other authorities? And number two, is it okay if someone has that objection, like me, to a certain thing, such as modifying unique, very unique, quite unique, and that's my thing, and certain people have advised me that I should let go of it. But I'm just asking you if you have that yourself, and is it okay to hang on to it? Or am I a bad person? So.
You want to? Gosh, that was such an amusing question. I don't even know how to answer it. But, I'm so glad I can't remember many of the examples of this where I will just stop reading a book because the person did some terrible sentence. I just can't go on with it. What was the other question? What was the other part that is?
Misuse of a particular thing that's a change that drives you nuts.
Well, the word. Yes.
Right.
I don't have that. Things like that happen so much that I'm not obsessed with that so much. But I've become sort of obsessed with how people use the word sublime. Because the way I understand, I almost never use it because I associate it with, my interpretation of it, my first acquaintance with it is the sublime is something so awesome and even terrifying. Mm. But people now use it to mean something blissful. It's as if it's been defanged. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But you'll say, you know, oh, this is so good, it's sublime. And I think, no. But I think that, so that's my one. I actually spent a class in which we were supposed to be discussing the rebellion of Nat Turner. And the word sublime was all I could discuss. Was Nat Turner's rebellion sublime? And in its original, it was horror. It had horror and, awesomeness of a horrible kind to it. And so, my students are used to the new way of using sublime as something ecstatic, something so so wonderful that it has an internal pleasure that's almost erotic. And so every time I hear the word sublime, I kind of get a little crazy, but then I don't say anything about it.
And then, of course, as a lexicographer, we love all of these new uses of words, because that is what we love to describe. And in fact, we see pedants who love to write to the dictionary and say how literal should not be used in that way, and you are legitimizing it by putting it in the dictionary and describing its use. But if people are using that in such a degree and over a significant number of years, then we must describe it. Yeah.
And this is how I know I'm becoming an old person, because the word sublime is just, why are you using it?
Fascinating. My question is on the use of the inclusion of foreign words and what criteria there were for including those. It seems as though there just might have been a really wide selection, right? How did the editors treat that? And for example, words that would capture a sense that was not described in English but might have been in another language, like what was the treatment? And did those become anglicized? And if so, how was that handled?
So basically, they considered a word English as long as it was used in an English context. So as long as that word occurred surrounded by other English words. What you find when you look at the treatment, or rather when you look at the history of many loan words, there is a pattern in how they appear in a printed source. So either they might start, when they're first introduced into English, they'll be in inverted commas, or they'll have a translation in brackets afterwards, or then they might be in italics when the rest of the sentence isn't. So there is a gradual sort of naturalization which writers will use. I don't know whether you've, in your own writing, if you're ever using a Caribbean word, whether you've... I didn't see you ever put it in italics or in inverted commas.
No,
it's just... Exactly.
I had a question about the way... what is gained and what is lost in the conflict of the words being... like this gentleman was saying, like in the ways that people have traditionally used words and start to use them colloquially.
What is gained?
What is gained, and what do you find that is gained or lost in the conflict, in the way that people use words colloquially, and the way that they are maybe people feel that they should be used in the old way? Does that make sense?
I don't think I can answer gain. I don't think I can answer. Because, I don't know what's...
I guess that you might see that one gain or one positive is that you are seeing words used in an innovative, dynamic way by people. So they are claiming the word and using it as they want to use it.
Yes, but
Hi. I was brought up in New York City with parents who... taught me to look up every word I didn't know in the dictionary. But I had problems when I went out of town and came back, and I picked up the New York Daily News, and I couldn't understand the headlines, and I had to ask my father to reinterpret them, to interpret them for me. But now I'm finding that there are new uses of the language that I don't have anyone to turn to for. One of the last two issues of the New Yorker, there was a piece by a young woman, in which she wrote about somebody she had been told about. I heard that she was a woke girl, and I could only imagine that she meant something like self-aware, somebody who, you know, who had been through some kind of self-realization.
Do you remember the name of the title of the piece?
You know, I don't. It's within the last two New Yorkers, and if you read, it's within the first two paragraphs.
I think it was by my goddaughter.
Ah!
I will tell her. Cora.
I think that means like conscientize, like to come to consciousness. I wanted to say you spoke, Ms. Kincaid spoke about kind of empire and the English language and kind of broken English in Antigua, right? And I just want to read this little part from A Small Place where you kind of go through that kind of lament or mourning for what was lost by being presented to the world by English. You wrote something about, do you know why people like me are shy about being capitalists? Well, it's because we, for as long as we have known you, were capital like bales of cotton and sacks of sugar, and you were the commanding, cruel capitalist, and the memory of this is so strong. And so I wanted to know kind of from A Small Place, that kind of tension that you describe in that novel of the English language is kind of almost erasing this stuff that you've never known. And how you kind of contend with that, and especially in relation to this kind of what was being talked about, the scientific era of the mid-1800s, right, which we know science didn't come in a vacuum, right? It wasn't objective. It was within this kind of discourse on colonialism.
I think what you're asking me, I think, what if I understand what you're asking me is, something I've thought about a lot. The language I use to describe and the injustice, the historical injustice of starts with, say, 1492. The language I have is the language of the people who committed the violation. And so does the word, for instance, the word justice, does it mean the same thing to the two different people with the two different experiences, the violator and the violated? Can they use the same language? And is it how complicated it is for the violated to have to describe their suffering in the language of the people who did the violation? And this is it's not a political question. It's a existential philosophical question. And it's, you know, some people, like I think the African writer Ngugi will sometimes write only in an African language because he thinks that that's the only way to separate this question. I don't necessarily agree. In fact, I don't agree with that at all, and I also don't disagree with it. I think the language you have is the language you should use, and in any case, language, you can't depend on language alone to describe and make authentic the suffering you are describing. Everybody knows what happens. You don't have to say it. The thing that should happen is what has happened on happen, and that's impossible. Mm-hmm. And so you are back to language, and you do the best with it that you can.
Okay.
Time for one
question. Okay. So I went to all English language school in Bulgaria during communism. We started all the subjects in English. It was a prestigious school. So speaking of the English language and the context, there was no connection between the words that we are studying and the reality that we were experiencing. Most of the words didn't make any sense. So, but when I came to America, I dropped the British accent and my British education. Because I realized that I'm Bulgarian. And I increased my accent, Bulgarian accent, and my Bulgarian identity. And I started learning Bulgarian literature and Bulgarian history. So in a way, through this osmosis, I became Bulgarian when I came to the United States, and I dropped the British background or the British education. But this is my question to you. Do you speak other languages? And if you do, do you have any favorite word from those languages?
To both of us, the question?
You.
I do not speak any other language. I tried to speak French and in France, and I was laughed at, and I decided never to speak French again. But actually, I'm interested in your story because you sound like a Danilo Kish novel. Do you know his? Yes. It's exactly. He's a Bulgarian. Brilliant, utterly great writer. So your question of language and identity and dropping and picking up sounds exactly... and if you don't know who Danilo Kish is, am I pronouncing K-I-S, is you should go right out and buy one of his novels or the short story. The great novel is Garden Ashes. Yes. But... So,
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.